So let's dive right into atomic executions. Memory barriers were the means of choice for the problems that we faced last time when it was about just getting your stores into meaningful order. This was mainly about coordinating state transitions between threads that were at some point modeling some kind of automaton, and a protocol between several of those. And that was a thing that's mainly important for areas where you require programs to have only very minimal overhead in terms of what the runtime system can provide. It'd be a thing for microcontrollers and very small scaled systems where you don't have a full-grown scheduler and all that. But in larger systems, you also have the need for synchronization between each other. And this very specific pattern that we have seen as an example in the last lecture, the Decker's algorithm already tried to establish one of these recurring principles, which was the principle of mutual exclusion, where you would try to protect a certain critical area from malicious accesses. So that is something that's going to be a recurring problem in larger programs. So that is something that needs our attention and a certain or well, pays off to invest some work into that. So the idea is now to generalize the reoccurring concept of enforcing mutual exclusion with the idea of something called the atomic execution. And what does that mean? That means that we're not only talking about one particular variable on which we are synchronizing each other, but we are now interested in computing several values that make sense together, so to say. And in the sense of dependencies, as we had it on the last few lectures, that means that we have dependencies from the thread to several of these variables now, like this. And there's also information flow from these to one point in the program. So this is kind of the new concept that's introduced with this atomic execution. So what is the general setup for something like that, the setting in which we are working now? Well, first of all, we are now going to the concept of resources, which are in many cases areas of memory where we can, for example, map I/O into, or just other plain variables which we access from several threads, so that we get this generalized concept of resources. For example, you can have file I/O mapped into memory or something. So that is this concept of resources. And for each of these resources, you have certain ideas of what must be a valid assumption on these. So you kind of try to establish an invariant on the resource that needs to be valid all the time that you access such a resource. For example, if you have a multi-thread program and you access a common data structure like a double-ended list, you somehow need to make sure that at each time that you try to access that thing somehow, the head and tail pointer of that list must point to a valid item in that list for once, and for second, you need that they are in some sense synchronous in the sense that the head's pointer points back to exactly the element that then points to the head once again. So they need to be in the right order, and that needs to be in every case that you access the double end list. So that's an invariant that needs to be intact. So the thing that makes the whole problem complicated now is that an invariant might not incorporate only one particular single memory cell, but might span over several of these resources. So it's not in every case you can encode all the information that you need to retain throughout the life cycle of your program in just one memory cell. So there's several resources in many cases involved in anything, and as these are in potentially different locations of the memory, there's situations where you just can't access all of them in one go, in one single instruction. So if you try to modify something in your data structure, for example, then you might be tempted to temporarily invalidate the invariant. You break it on purpose in order to reestablish it shortly after, but with a new state involved. And so the thing is that although there's this concept of an invariant in there, you might be tempted at some point to break it on purpose and reassemble everything that's needed for an invariant after. So that's fine as long as you are the only one who's accessing that particular data structure. As soon as you have several participants accessing the same data structure, you already see the problem. If one of the threads updates the data structure at that particular point, you run into consistency problems in there. So, that's what makes the whole problem. Okay, so in order to fight that, you would, in an ideal world, just want to put your text marker and just mark the respective parts of your code as, well, I want these parts to be atomic, and I want them to be executed either all of them all together, so that nobody can make out that I have done so in several steps, or I might want to have the resources look like they would still be in the state that they were before I issued that thing. So on all, what you want the whole system to have is that it looks like the invariant looks intact. So, there's several degrees of how far we can carry that concept, depending on how strictly we restrict the properties that our algorithms will have. All of the things that we're going to talk about in that will be things for the mainstream machine models. Like we can test them on the desktop computers, and can be found in some way or another in different compilers that are available there. So we can try them out in the tutorials. Yeah, and those are the approaches that are kind of state of the art for establishing certain means of synchronization and atomic execution in there. What I'm going to show you in particular is the, well, the principal things for atomic executions, so the kind of for the foundations. Then we are going to talk about first class of algorithms, in particular the weight-free algorithms that we're going to implement based on these atomic operations that we have first introduced. Then we're going to go over to log-free algorithms. I think I forgot them over here. So there's still the log-free algos. And we're going to talk about algorithms that that implement things like the mutex semaphore monitor. Maybe you've seen or used those things already in other lectures. And then in the end, as we have then established locked or potentially locking algorithms, we're going to talk about deadlocks and how to prevent them. So that will be the last part. So that's it for today. Let's dive right in. First of all, atomic execution. The kind of basic thing that all of them have in common is that the idea that the effect of such an atomic execution is seen as a single transformation of the memory. So if someone else tries to access these memory parts that are touched by the atomic execution all the time and tries to read out these resources, the only way that he will see these parts of memory is that either they are they stay the same value, or they the new values are observable at or after one particular point in time. So there's one one event that makes the whole transformation of memory visible to all the other accessors of that memory push. That will be considered as an atomic execution. Of course, that is very general, and we have several subcategories of atomic executions out there, and we have seen a few of them already mentioned in the outline of today's lecture. First of all, there's the class of weight-free atomic executions. These are atomic executions which, for once, always succeed and never block. So that is kind of the holy grail of atomic executions. If the execution always succeeds and never blocks, that's kind of the ideal world that we want to live in. Then there's the next class of atomic executions, the lock-free ones. These are ones that also never block, but not in every case. It may be that they succeed, but they also may fail for certain situations. But at least they never block, so they are kind of lock-free. So this already sounds a little bit more depressing, but we'll see that that's, you can still do things with that. Then there's another notion where you have the class of locked atomic executions, or potentially locking atomic executions. These are ones that always succeed. So that part is once again fulfilled. But they potentially may block the thread. So this is kind of the other way around, that the so there's the weight freeze that give you all, there's lock free that gives you only never blocking, and there's locked that gives you always succeeding but maybe not terminating. And in those cases they probably also don't succeed, but as they're not terminated yet, you don't really talk about whether they succeeded or not. And Then, in the end, there's the concept of the transaction, which is an atomic execution that may fail in some sense. That's also something that is, well, somehow related, of course, to the log-free things, but we will see them on different levels. And that is because we have also other ways of differentiating between them, namely in the kind of the dimension that the transaction has, in the sense of the amount of data that you can touch throughout your atomic execution. So that is one thing to differentiate, and especially the lock freeze and the transaction type of atomic executions have a very different amount of data that they are going to talk about. So the lock free class is very narrow, very for just a small amount of data, while the transaction will have a lot more of data that can be covered with that. Then there's the expressivity, which is kind of another dimension that needs to be addressed for atomic executions or operations. For certain ones of those, you can only perform very simple transformations on the memory. For others, you can kind of execute complete programs in there. So, yeah, there are differences in the expressivity that they allow. And there's the granularity of objects in memory that are necessary for them to work. So these are three other these aspects that you're gonna talk about together with these atomic executions. So let's dive right into them, starting with the kind of most basic group of all of them, which are the so-called weight-free atomic executions. So from the examples that I show you, you can imagine, I show you here in that slide, you can imagine that these are pretty small portions of the program that we are going to talk about for the weight-free instructions. So here are a few of them. Which one of them would you say is atomic? Program 3? Who thinks program 3 is atomic? Or program 2? That's only two lines. It's not atomic, okay. How about program 1? Oh, there's a few hands up there. Okay. Why is everyone else not showing up for program 1? You need to what?
I need the value before the increment.
So what you're gonna, what I want to say, you first want to load the value from the memory before you can modify, and then so now we're already in the internals of how the whole thing is actually realized. There are several ways of translating this particular particular instruction. So what you can do, for example, is you can first do a load in assembly. You can do the actual increment, and then you can save it. Yeah, but you seem to be in favor of the whole thing being atomic. You could maybe argument with there's this assembly instruction of increment, for example.
Well, I know the command fetching increment, and that is considered atomic operating.
Fetching increment, yeah, that's an on the level that I think that we're talking about is now the kind of a C level, isn't it? So this would be a solution afterwards. However, the thing is, how is it implemented? And that's the question that in that case. So, well, anyway, one of the answers could have been there's this increment instruction, and it's only one instruction, so that already looks quite atomic, doesn't it? And yeah, the thing is, in principle, that might be the case. However, although kind of the assembly, well, the assembly layer on the machine is kind of an interface to the programmer, so to say. And although it looks like just one simple instruction, it still needs to perform these actions that you that you have mentioned: this loading process, this computation, and the store. And for a single core, for example, the you would schedule only at the borders of your instruction. When it has when one instruction has terminated, you would kind of deschedule and do something else. In that case, the instruction would be quite atomic. However, in a case where we have several cores, you could still have the cores interlocked in one particular way, where both of them, for example, start an increment on the same thing, and they're just off by one cycle or something. Something that still permits to access memory in between. And that would still lead to an interleaving that would violate your atomicity in that case. So although it seems to be quite quite atomic, it still is not, even if you have hardware models which don't feature the advanced things like the invalidate buffers or store buffers. However, that's the other thing that you have already indicated is, well, all of them can be made atomic executions. You just need to be aware that in those cases, they need to be translated in a different way and not the obvious just one particular increment that just doesn't do the job. In certain cases, for example, well, not for example, but in particular, if the I is in memory, you can do the following thing. That's something that's allowed by the infrastructure. You can lock the cache bus, the thing that does the communication between all the caches on your system. You can kind of completely shut it down until your instruction has finished executing for a specific address. So the bus can still be used for other addresses, but messages concerning the specific memory address that you do your instruction on are simply rejected in that particular time. So what you get with that is that there's just no interference between those cache lines possible, because, well, there's no message concerning that particular address possible on the message bus. So you can do that on the assembly level by your box standard increment of instruction. However, what you need to do is you need to flag it as one that locks down the message, the messages concerning the address that you're talking about with this lock prefix. And there's a bunch of instructions for which you can do something like that. There's, for example, the xadd, where you can do the I think it's an exchange and add, isn't it? Is there any fancy assembly programmer around? No one doing assembly programming for fun and cash? No? Okay, that's a novelty. Never had that situation. Okay, but the thing is that this exchange and add would be exactly the thing that's necessary for here. So you would return the old value of the I while still updating it. So you would pick the old value from there and increment by k with that. So you move the k into a register. You execute the xadd exactly without anyone else interfering on the address for the I, and then move the old value of I, which is then found in EAX, into your variable j. So that's what's going on there. And then there's the swap, which is implemented with program 3, and yeah, that's a simple exchange. So that's also one instruction which you can precede with your lock prefix, and that will perform the trick for you. So these are hardware given things, and yeah, without just that lock, you might have an interleaving with a store from another processor, which might then break your atomicity. Yeah, that's something that is quite an interesting thing, and at least in the past, there have been students who didn't believe that would actually be a thing. So you can just implement simple test programs where you just let the threads race for the variable I, for example, where you just perform these things here, and then compare afterwards how many times you actually have executed the increment and what the actual value of the increment is now, and yeah, that might have a few surprises in store for you. Anyway, these are algorithms that look quite small. It's just well, 1, 2, 3 lines as far as we have seen them. However, they are still they already represent situations that come quite handy for certain situations. That's an example that's taken from kind of an operating system context. It's a very simple part in terms of algorithm. However, if you do that in a parallel manner, you get into a lot of problems. It's the allocation of new free memory, and yeah, there's this concept of the bumper pointer. That's just you get a large area of memory, which is considered to be free and to be given away to processes via the allocation routine, via this alloc thing. And yeah, the things that your allocation pointer points to the first free cell in memory, and as soon as someone wants to allocate new memory, that particular call of alloc needs to increment the first free pointer by the amount of memory that the process needs, and the algorithm needs to return the pointer to the first free memory cell as it has been before the allocation, because that is the first memory cell that's considered to be free. So in areas where you have only one particular thread, you could think of this code to do the job. So what you would do is you would consider your heap to be some area in the memory, and in the first at first you would consider the first free pointer to point to, well, the beginning of your heap, and in the end it will point to some arbitrary value depending on the usage of the memory. And your algorithm would first of all try to access the first free pointer and save the current pointer to a local variable start, and then it would increment the first free by a certain amount. That's exactly the pattern that you have seen on the slide before for the second algorithm. So you obtain a value and then increment it in the next line. And depending on what's necessary next, you would probably at some point try to evaluate the address that the thing, the point to, and if it is exceeding the heap, you would try to make room for new heap fragments, and do so by calling garbage collection or something, and in the end return the start value. So that's fine as long as it's just one thread accessing the whole thing. As soon as you have, different threads working on shared heap, you will get the problem that as soon as the scheduler decides to deschedule your process right here in the middle, you will read a first free value that is before descheduling, and then save this until you at some point get rescheduled again, and then you will modify the first free pointer to be adjusted by the right size. However, you will still consider the first free that you have read out before you were descheduled as the one that would be valid at that point of time. And well, if there's another alloc in between, you are screwed at that point because you have completely garbled up your memory management. And yeah, that's a perfect example of where to actually perform your atomic execution. You need to perform that atomically, the readout of the first free and the addition of the size to the first free pointer. So what you can do for a thread safe implementation is the following. You can implement that by moving on to this locked version of the exchange and add. You would have to first of all move the size into the EAX, of course, but then you could just use this locked exchange and add, which would shut down the cache bus for the address of first free, so you can exclusively work on the first free address until your instruction is finished, and only then make it available for all the other calls of allocation again. That requires inline assembler, or well, in some situations there's this compiler internal. Let it be macros or function calls that you can call, which encapsulate these algorithms for you. But you need to do something to achieve the atomic character of these kinds of things. You don't get them for free. So rather than writing assembler code that's really tedious in any way, we will move on to some kind of made-up keyword. So there's this keyword atomic, which we, well, of course, that's not a valid keyword in C or C++ in any way. But we consider that as kind of a of our abstraction of what you would actually have to do in order to achieve atomic execution of the underlying things. It just makes reasoning about these things easier on the slides. However, if you read something like this atomic, what's actually meant is the underlying weight-free implementations of these operations. In addition to that, as you have seen, that we can use these especially prefixed instructions for weight-free algorithms. We don't have an arbitrary set of them. We only have limited instructions that we can use, and also, it's just one single instruction that can be prefixed with something like that. If you do several of them after each other, they are atomic for themselves, but not as a unity. So you cannot make an arbitrary use of this of these atomic markers that we have here. It's just for instruction sequences that are actually possible to be implemented in an atomic way on the underlying hardware. And that depends on what the hardware gives you. So in the atomic block, you would see them as atomic execution that would fulfill the needs that we have seen beforehand for atomic executions, meaning that at the start, you get a dependency on that the modifications of the memory are happening after the start of the atomic block, and the end of the atomic block would have to be preceded by the events that transform the memory. So that is the kind of the setting for the whole thing, and yeah, that's what we have already said. Atomic is only translatable when there's corresponding atomic CPU instructions that you can actually use to translate these things. However, we will treat this atomic thing as our high-level representation of that. Yeah. So the weight-free algorithms are limited to a single instruction. That is whatever is offered on your architecture. There's well, in general, there's no control flow possible with these instructions. There's only a few exceptions where we have kind of a control flow in there. So this no behavioral change depending on data is not completely true, but there's no kind of high level constructs that you can surround with these atomic things, something like while loops or for loops or complicated switch cases or something. That's not possible in these weight-free entities. There's a few that can execute operations conditionally, depending on one single evaluation of value of a memory cell or of well of a condition. So what you also get is these ones here, where you set a specific memory cell to a value of your choice. In this case, it's this B thing, which you in this case set to 0, or in this case to 1, and get back as a result of your operation the value that the particular memory cell has had before. So that is your result that you get. And that's kind of encoding instructions that will try to set a certain flag to a value in any way, but tells you whether the flag has been of particularly that value before or not. That's usable as kind of a building block for a larger algorithm where you can just perform setting a flag to a certain value and then check whether someone else has already done that, and if so, you maybe want to do that once again, looping as long as you get a situation where you were the one who flipped the flag, for example. So we'll see an example for that a little bit later. Then there's also the other thing with the very simple conditional assignment. So that is this one here, where you evaluate a certain condition. In our case here, that's equality check, but there might also be others encoded. That depends a little bit on the architecture that you're on. And in case that the condition is actually true, then you would perform another assignment over here. So these are the types of atomic instructions that you would call the compare and swaps. And the other ones with a flag that you would set to a certain value while being able to know whether you have flipped them or not are these modify and test ones. So these are kind of common names for them. They might not directly translate to API calls, but something pretty similar to that is what you will find either in the API functions name directly or in the documentation of that. I always have to say that because there's actually really differences between the, for once, the architectures, then the operating systems, and the compiler manufacturers. So there's just no standard for that, which is a pity, but we have to live with that. So all of these things, together with the programs that we have seen before on the other slide, can be used as building blocks. We can use them to program other more abstract algorithms that might do more work for us if we just don't want to focus only on these one or two memory cells, but even more. So these are building blocks, and we can use them for algorithms that can actually fail, but if they succeed, they will have performed something. You have heard me sketching already one of these types of algorithms when I talked about this flipping of the flag. That is one of the typical failable algorithms where you fire off this one of these modify and test instructions and afterwards evaluate whether the whole thing was successful, whether you were actually switching the flag or whether it has already been switched to the state that you wanted and you have to try again because you somehow failed to be the one to switch the flag. That will lead us into the area of lock-free algorithms, which are now one layer above the plain wait-free algorithms. So in cases where your application just needs to be covering more data than just a plain wait-free instruction can provide, you might want to go one level higher and go and, well, drop the property that your algorithm will succeed in all cases, but yeah, you might still want to have your algorithm lock-free. And yeah, the common use pattern for compare and swap is one of the typical things. I've sketched that already for you, but now you find it also as kind of an algorithm on there. What you do is you read the initial value of I, which is the variable that we're gonna erase during that algorithm, into K, using memory barriers, of course. Then what you would do is you would compute a new value for this K in general. In the special case that we were talking about before, that would be just an increment, but you can imagine an arbitrary function that just yields another integer value as the as admissible at that point. And then what you would do is, in case that this the original I that you're that you were doing your computation on is still holding the same old value on which you did your computation, you might want to say, well, I've I have computed a new version of that, and I want to update that part of the memory with my newly computed value. Then what you would do is you would exchange them in the case that I is still K. In the case that I has changed in the short time span that was while you were computing your update function, and the I is not the same value as the value that we were emanating on before, which is this K, then you would, well, try again with the thing before, where you read the now more recent value of I into K and repeat your computation and try to store away your new result into that thing. With that, you can kind of do different things. You could imagine fixed point algorithms being realized that way in a massive parallel way without synchronizing too much. You could just perform your computations and try to store them away in case that there's still the old value in there. That would be a thing to do. But there's also certain other constructs that we can make out of that. Okay, so the idea is to watch out for whether there are changes to I and whether this I is still the same value that we were emanating from. So that's this evaluating the equality between I and K. And if it is valid, then that implies that no other thread has updated the I. So what we can do is, given that, that we have a compare and swap operation for a certain amount of bytes, we can try to group variables for which the invariant must hold into these n bytes. So everything that we are depending on, we would try to put into the area that we can actually perform the compare and swap on. And yeah, with that, we can try to maximize the number of parameters or results that are going to touch with the computation up there. And yeah, the idea is to read these, recalculate a new value, and then do the compare and swap on that area that we are given by the hardware. The whole thing works as long as the computation of the new value is actually something which is repeatable, which means that you need all the external influences on that computation to be, well, non-present. There need to be no external dependencies on that thing, because as soon as they change, you can't re-compute your value in a meaningful way. Okay, these wait and lock-free algorithms have, of course, limitations in terms of their expressivity. That was one of the dimensions that we have talked about in how these algorithms are actually different to each other. So the property that the whole thing is a single atomic operation is, of course, one major limitation in there. We have talked about this compare and swap being one of those principles. There's this modify and test. Other categories, what you have is exchange memory cell. It was, the exchange thing. And then the other thing is also a fetch and add on integers. That's the things that you are in generally be able to do. And these are in most cases just allowing for one memory operand. With that, however, you can already implement a whole lot of higher level algorithms, which might come in handy for algorithms that touch larger amounts of memory and somehow break a few of the limitations in terms of expressivity that the wait and lock-free algorithms have. In particular, what you can implement is you can implement binary semaphores, which is essentially a flag that can be acquired if free and released once again. Then you can have these things called the counting semaphores, which is kind of pretty similar to that, but instead of just a flag being flipped from 0 to 1, you can go even more and kind of count the number of times you access the thing and decrease the number of these accesses by releasing this semaphore a few times. You can also have things like mutexes, which ensure mutual exclusion, usually with the help of a binary semaphore, and you can have monitors that are in most cases all pretty similar to mutexes, but for the thing that you can re-enter these mutexes in case that you have already entered them at a certain point, but we will see about that a little later on. All in all, these things will be called locks from now on, and we'll see how they are actually implemented in the next few slides when we talk about the locked atomic executions. So, locks in general, a lock data structure, what is that? It is always a thing that tries to restrict access to a so-called critical section. Critical section is a piece of code that is kind of essential for being executed non-interlocked with another instance of either the same critical section or one that is related with via the same kind of lock structure. We will see how to do that a little bit later on. The thing is that you want to have this protection of a critical section in order to make sure that the execution of the code does not produce incorrect results. Think back to the notion of invariants, for example, for the double-ended lists, where you have where you rely on the certain invariants to actually hold in order to be able to access the memory in a meaningful way. So that would be a typical critical section. Whenever you try to update the structure of such a double-ended list, you would want to do that only without any other participant of the communication interfering with your data structure at that particular point of time. So that's what your critical section would be for. Yeah, such a lock data structure then would be the one to ensure that mutual exclusion is actually happening on those critical sections. No two threads can execute these sections then at once. And in case that someone actually tries to do that, you would kind of block the other threads as soon as they try to start entering these critical sections. In general, there's these words, these terms for entering and leaving these critical sections, and, which we use to be acquired and released. So you can acquire and release such a semaphore or lock or whatever the particular structure actually is. All in all, that's that sounds quite useful in terms of expressivity. However, what you buy into is, well, as these algorithms are already called this locking or locked algorithms, is they in the end might lead to a deadlock in the program. So we need to take care that that's not actually happening. So let's dive right into these types of data structures and algorithms. So let's begin with a semaphore. A semaphore is essentially, first of all, in terms of data structure, just a plain integer. In this case, we call it S, with together with a few operations that are always used to access that particular memory area. And yeah, there's two operations that are associated with that. For once, there's the signal. Signal is, in this case, a very simple one, where we just do an increment on the underlying integer, and we do so in an atomic fashion. So this means that at that point, we will apply our weight-free implementation of the increment to get an atomic increase of the underlying integer of the semaphore. Then there's the other peer of the whole thing, which is the weight. The weight has a local flag available that it is using to check whether the whether the semaphore is actually available. Well, if we talk about something like available, we already get the notion that this weight will probably be the candidate for guarding the access to the critical section of a program, thus probably will be the one that implements the acquire of said lock here. So weight is kind of the acquire, and with that, signal will be its counterpart, the release of that particular lock. So we have the introduced an identifier for the availability here. And yeah, what we will do is, once again, we will perform an atomic instruction. And what we will do here is a this sequence of instructions, which is a condition. And depending on the condition, we will perform a specific update on the memory. So this is one of these conditional update things. So a special type of weight-free instruction that's applied here. And yeah, what does it do? It checks as condition whether the underlying integer is actually still positive. And if it is positive, then we consider the semaphore to be still available. And if it is so, what we'll do is we will decrease the integer underlying the semaphore. And in that case, if it was available, then the while condition will evaluate to false, and we can just exit the whole thing. With that, we will terminate the wait, and the thread can go on. In case that the whole thing was not available, we didn't perform a decrease on the underlying integer, and instead, what we would do is we would loop back to the beginning and not continue our execution. That would be this the state where the acquirer would be somehow locked. The thread that tries to enter the critical section will end up in a loop, which, well, depending on whether our condition, which we evaluate into this available flag, will at some point turn out to grow positive again at some point. When that is the case, then we will unlock that particular acquire and make the critical section available for the thread that tries to access the whole thing. And if not, then it will keep iterating until the end of time. Yeah, the other counterpart, the signal, which is this release, is the one who actually is supposed to be called after you have exited the critical section, and is the one that is responsible for making the critical section available for other threads once again, and it does so by re-increasing the underlying integer s by just one, and if that suffices, then the next thread might then enter the critical section, because the available flag will then be evaluated to true, and the whole thing will be able to exit the loop. So that's how the semaphore is actually internally implemented. Thread that acquires executes wait. If the resource is available, wait returns. If not, then it waits for someone else to call a signal in order to release the semaphore. And yeah, that's essentially it. Depending on how the whole system is initialized, you get different notions of such a semaphore. You can have binary semaphore if you initialize your underlying integer with just one. With that, you will just have one chance of evaluating the whole thing to positive. Well, because as soon as this wait is executed once, you will decrease the semaphore to zero, and that's not positive anymore in the sense of greater than zero. And you can only re-enter the whole thing as soon as a signal is called once again. So that would be the your binary semaphore. You can just use that to block and unblock a certain particular resource. And yeah, if you do so, you would call your data structure a mutex. So mutex is a special version of a semaphore. Of course, this is for purposes of showing it on the slides, it's very much it's very concise. In the case of a mutex, you would probably not want to make your signal like that, so that you could kind of count to a positive number for your semaphore at some point, because then you would then allow several people to enter your critical section, but you would implement it in another way. But yeah, for purposes of keeping everything just small and compact, we will keep it like that. Of course, you could argument that that is quite of a bad implementation, in the sense that you would keep all the threads that are supposed to wait for the availability of the semaphore looping. That is something that you don't want to do. So as we have talked about, the idea of a semaphore is to be executed on a machine that allows for a higher abstraction and more runtime overhead and all that. You can imagine that you would have a scheduler on such a system, and for those systems you would be able to give away your slot that has been scheduled to you back to the scheduler with a thing like yield or deschedule or something, and that's what you can apply right there in the implementation of the semaphore. The only thing that you have to change in there is that you don't directly perform the while loop, but you would instead beforehand give the scheduling a chance to do something meaningful with the time that you would have to wait anyway, and would just loop around and rely on the idea that the critical section is only short, and at some time the semaphore would be available again for oneself. And yeah, with the deschedule, you can at some point you will be rescheduled and can continue at that point. So you would give away the time slot that is associated to you back to the scheduler to enable other computations to be done in that time. You would establish these descheduling calls, especially with a hint on what memory area the one was that your algorithm was failing on. And the operating system, especially one on a more sophisticated machine, would then be able to monitor every write that happens to the address that you have given to the deschedule. And in case that there has been a change onto particularly that address, then you would be rescheduled once again and be able to continue and re-evaluate your condition, whether everything is now fine for you to be executed. So, yeah, that is quite a nice idea in general to avoid doing this thing. However, I think that this is already, that is on the next slide. The thing is that the this is just a very, very naive way of thinking how these semaphores are actually implemented. Turns out that depending on the use case for which you have your semaphores, you could offer different versions of these to the programmers. There's, for example, situations where we have a lot of, where you have a critical section which is very small, which is only updating very, very few of any variables, or just a very short piece of code that's executed in there. And in those situations, it might be a good idea not to go back to the scheduler and enter yourself in the threading queue and wait on any modifications on the address, because the other process might be so fast in completing its critical section and releasing the semaphore once again that after one or two cycles in the loop, you will hit the situation that you are permitted to acquire that lock anyway. So there's optimizations in the sense that you would not directly go back to scheduling, but instead try to iterate a few times through the process of trying to acquire until you reach a certain limit, and only then go to descheduling. And there's a whole lot of different ideas out there of specialized semaphores that have different behavior depending on what your actual application demands for you. And there's also ideas of having automatically different implementations of the acquire routine depending on certain measurements that are done on the critical section of your code. And yeah, there's a whole lot of things possible out there. And yeah, the things that we see here are only very, very simple, simplified versions of that. Okay. So the other thing is that in case of just single core computers, well, using a semaphore is quite an easy thing. You only have to implement just counting down or counting up once again, and yeah. So with single cores, that's just that. Mutexes. I think I have mentioned what a mutex is already a few slides before. That was a special type of semaphore that is just to with two pairs in most of the cases, where you just want to guarantee mutual exclusion in the sense that only one of the pairs is actually able to access the critical section. In these cases, the binary semaphore is also called mutex, and yeah, you could, for example, imagine a mutex to be a meaningful data structure and algorithm for protecting such a double-ended queue or any other data structure that has certain invariants and needs to be accessed in parallel. Yeah. So, yeah, for these, you need to decide what needs to be protected or not. Even more, next thing is monitors. These are things that are that come into play in areas where you where you have identified a common recurring pattern that how certain mutexes are actually used, and that idea is that in a few cases you have these very short methods or functions or procedures or anything that immediately after they have started acquire a lock and only release the lock upon exit of that function. For that specific purpose, monitor could be used in order to facilitate work on that, especially as there is certain problems with that approach, in the sense that, first of all, of course, generalization is always one of the key drivers for certain constructs. But the other thing is that there's actually a problematic thing coming with that concept of just locking at the beginning and releasing at the end, especially if you have ideas like recursive calls, where you would want to implement, for example, if you want to delete the nth item of your list at some point, you could implement that on such a linked list by just doing it in a recursive way. And in those cases, if you try to do this locking at the begin of the remove or delete function, then you would, as soon as you hit the second layer of your recursion, you would hit a deadlock because you already own the specific lock and it's locked at that point. So the idea would be to come up with something more flexible, which would be the re-entrant mutex or monitor. It's the third thing I think we can ignore right now. Even if you don't have recursion, you might want, for example, to implement several critical sections on your data structure that have the same lock in use, because you might want to tinker with your with your data structure. Well, yeah, with the structure of your data structure, and kind of break the invariant for a short amount of time. But you might have several spots in your implementation that which is distributed over several methods or functions where you would want to break the invariant. In those cases, it is it's often protected with the same lock to make sure that other accessors of the whole thing get all of these critical sections excluded. So in those cases, it doesn't even need to be a recursive call, but if you implement, for example, something which is very basic, which you want to call from other manipulating functions, and if you try to call that inside while you already have acquired the lock, and inside of that basic routine you also acquire the lock because it might be executed from somewhere outside, then you get into the same situation. So it doesn't necessarily need to be always a recursive call, but it also can be a call to just another method or function that just uses the same lock. So for all of these situations, you would like to have something like a reentrant mutex, which is what the monitor is supposed to solve for you. So if you apply something like a monitor, what we'll do is you essentially have a semaphore, which if the lock is already taken, proceeds just without blocking anymore, but just lets you enter the critical section as you are already the thread which owns that particular lock and can access the critical section. So the thing is now that if you want something like that, you need to make sure that everything is in order in the sense that you want to acquire and release in a fashion that if you call the first release, you don't want to give away all the claims to that specific lock that you had before. Only if you had the same amount of releases as you had acquires, only then you want to kind of release the lock in a global way and let someone else take possession of that particular lock. So for that, you will need a little bit more. So instead of just the plain counter that we had in the semaphore, you will have the count once again, but also another item, which is the thread ID, TID here, that is supposed to be the basic structure for such a monitor. And with that, you would have an acquire and a release method in the sense that you have the monitor enter and the monitor leave, and they ensure the mutual exclusion of all the accesses of the of that monitor. All the while, it tracks the times that the acquire or monitor enter is actually called, and only when the same amount of monitor leaves or releases have been called, the monitor would be considered as completely released and free for other threads to be acquired. And you could do that like the way you see here. You would introduce the notion of ownership with this Boolean mine that needs to be set accordingly, and while the monitor is not yours or mine in that case, what we will do is we want to perform an atomic access, and the mine would be implemented in the way that, well, we would compare the thread ID with the monitor's TID, and only if they would be the same, we would increase the count. In the case that we already own the monitor, we can safely just increase the times of acquires that we have performed on that. And in the case that that was not mine, yet the thread ID is not set to any meaningful value, we can still set the thread ID to ours and have the count initialized with one, because we are the first one to access the whole thing. And yeah, if the whole thing was not successful, if we have not been able to secure this monitor for us, we need to deschedule on the address of the thread ID and at some point continue throughout the while, and only when we have been successfully acquiring the monitor, we can leave the whole thing and continue with executing the critical section. The counterpart is the monitor leave, in which we will do the following. We will perform the decrement, and in case that we have reached zero, we will release the we will release the monitor in the sense that we will give up ownership on the monitor data structure by setting the thread ID to zero, and that will be the event that the scheduler will use to wake up someone else and make him the new owner of the whole thing. So it already gets a lot more complicated. You might wonder that the atomic block is looks quite large in that example. That's mostly because, you can move out a lot of the stuff that's in there in the area before, but that would mean that I would have to introduce a lot more of the of local variables and other things. For example, the thread ID doesn't need to be in the atomic part, but if I introduce that, the algorithm becomes longer and longer, and in order to have it more readable, I have just not done it like that. Also, if you try to linearize the whole thing, you will see that with the assembly instructions, you can shrink down the amount of instructions that you actually need to perform atomic. But as these atomic things have been introduced with this notion of having matching brackets that limits my expressibility of what I actually need to be atomic in there. So I only need a very small part of the whole thing to be atomic, namely specifically the part where I manipulate and compare the thread ID part of the monitor. I only have this much of space here on the slide, and the essential is on there. You just have this this accessing the thread ID part of the monitor, and if you have made sure that you are the owner of that, you can do everything else without being atomic anymore, because nobody else can try to interfere with you anymore. So yeah. In general, that's what's happening inside the monitor, but it's just more complicated in practice because, yeah, you don't have that large atomic areas in there. Good. Still, there's issues of efficiency in there, especially when you imagine that there's there's ideas where you have data structures where you would wait for a certain event with the help of these monitors, and you need to somehow evaluate some conditions that have something to do with your monitor, and if you do so with the means that we have had so far, you will produce a lot of accesses to the critical section part, and thus have to have to compete for access to the lock a lot, and this leads to kind of busy waiting like situations on the lock data structure. So in order to get rid of that, there's the idea of creating the condition variable, which is an abstraction of the of this thing that you're actually querying for, and incorporate that into the our dealing with acquire and release, or wait and signal. But I think time has run out for that, so let's talk about condition variables next time. I think we already have had a lot of different structures, so thank you for your attention, and we'll meet again next week. Goodbye.